I say it's made a kind of a stuff. Other people have the theory that the real world is spiritual or mental. But I want you to point out that both those theories of the world are concepts. They're constructions of words. And the real world is not an idea. It is not words. Reality is... Find, therefore, that if you get with reality, all sorts of illusions disappear.
This is listener-sponsored Free Speech Radio, KPFK Los Angeles 90.7, and streaming worldwide at kpfk.org.
Support comes from CAP UCLA, presenting the Cy Anantum Devotional Ensemble on Sunday, April 13th at the Nimoy. Presented in partnership with the Hammer Museum, this evening of music, readings, and film is dedicated to the legacy of musician and spiritual leader Alice Coltrane, Turiya Sanghitananda. More information at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
You're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and live around the world at kpfk.org.
The New York Times published a lead column on January 18, 2025, titled, Are We Sleepwalking Into Autocracy? The columnist's answer is yes, unless, and I quote, defenders of democracy have to stay united, focusing on ensuring that checks and balances remain intact and that crucial democratic watchdog institutions elude capture. What is absent from the Times article is the complicity of the media and especially the New York Times in shutting down coverage of the fight by unions, grassroots movements, whistleblowers, and civic organizations, often led by the consumer advocate and former presidential candidate Ralph Nader, to placate their advertisers. This decision, made by newspapers such as the New York Times 4 decades ago, essentially erased these popular initiatives from public consciousness. This erasure, done to placate wealthy corporations and oligarchs and boost revenue, bolstered the power of corporations and the government to dominate and shape public discourse, and in the process saw them become ever more secretive and ever more autocratic. As Ralph Nader notes, the regular reporting about what activists were doing in the 1960s and 1970s made possible the consumer, environmental, labor, and freedom of information laws. Similar efforts now cannot gather momentum with media invisibility. Legislative hearings, prosecutions, and regulatory actions cannot get jump-started just by the people insistent on a just and democratic society. How often do you see op-eds from civic labor advocates, Ralph asks? How often do you read reviews of their books? How often do you see profiles of them? How often have the groundbreaking studies by Public Citizen, Common Cause, Center for Science and the Public Interest, Veterans for Peace, Union of Concerned Scientists, etc., received coverage? This erasure stands in stark contrast to the coverage given over to those on the far right and corporations. Figures like Donald Trump, Marjorie Taylor Greene, and Elon Musk get plenty of press. The media landscape is siloed. Media outlets, both the legacy media and the digital media, cater to well-defined demographics. But the power of the legacy media, should it decide to use its power, is to help set the agenda through its reporting. Most digital sites feed off of the reporting of the establishment media, spinning it left or right, and what it does not cover often does not get covered. Legions of reporters, 500 full-time reporters, cover the Congress, hundreds more sit at the feet of the titans of commerce and Wall Street, spit back to the public official communiques and fawning interviews with the powerful, the famous, and the rich. Unless they are deployed outside the halls of Congress and the centers of power, what is left of our democracy, and not much of it is left, will wither and die. Joining me to discuss our march towards tyranny, the complicity of institutions such as the media and the liberal class, including the Democratic Party, and what we must do to wrest back power is Ralph Nader, who has been fighting corporate power longer, more effectively, and with more integrity than any other American. Ralph, let's go back to where we were, because where we are now is a reaction to what you were at the epicenter of it built. We can begin with your groundbreaking book, Unsafe at Any Speed, which should be taught in every journalism school. It is a masterful piece of investigative reporting. But let's go back to what we had and then how they organized to take it away.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. It's very well documented, the whole history of it. When I wrote the book, Unsafe at Any Speed, a reporter for Science Magazine picked it up, and then the New York Times picked it up off of Science Magazine, and it made page one. And so that was a good start.
Ralph, I just want to interrupt for people who don't know. This were cars made by GM that were not safe.
Yeah, well, it was a critique of unsafely designed cars, cars without seatbelts, airbags, rollover bars, collapsing steering column, padded dash panels, all the things we take for granted now. And I led with a chapter on the Corvair, which is uniquely unstable in cornering maneuvers. At any rate, up until then, the press would never cover criticisms of cars by model or by manufacturer. They would refer to the Corvair, until we broke the taboo, as a middle-sized rear-engine car, and they wouldn't mention the name. All right, so we broke the taboo, and I began contacting members of Congress, because the next step after the book were congressional hearings in the tried and true tradition of Civics 101. So I lived in a boarding house, and I would call from a outside phone to members of Congress, and they would invariably say when they answered the phone, "Who are you with?" Well, in those days, the only answer you could give was, "I'm with a trade association or a corporation or a union." There were virtually no citizen groups operating at that time. So I would go down to Capitol Hill, and I would find the staff that was responsive. And there were, for example, Senator Ribicoff's staff, Senator Magnuson's staff. And then we would start having hearings. And before the hearings, I would call the Washington Post, New York Times, AP, UPI, Baltimore Sun, and the Wall Street Journal, and the Detroit papers, because it was on automobiles. And not long thereafter, I had a whole covey of reporters who wanted to cover what I was doing up there, wanted to cover the hearings. They didn't just do a feature hoping for a Pulitzer and then leave the subject entirely the way they do now. They did what was called regular reporting, beat reporting. And because I would get in those papers, it'd be a recall, it would be widely publicized, members of Congress began more and more to open their doors to me and to have hearings in the Senate and in the House. And the press feels more comfortable reporting hearings on corporate misbehavior or corporate crime than if citizens had some sort of rally, even then. So, to make a long story short, in a matter of a few months after the publication of Unsafe and Indiscreet, November 1965, by September, the Congress had passed the first bill ever to regulate the most powerful industry in the country at the time for safety standards, pollution control, and fuel efficiency. Three objectives. And they sent it to Lyndon Johnson, who had a signing ceremony, and he invited me there and gave me one of the pens, which I can't find now, by the way. So I was off to the races. So I figured, well, I don't want to be a lone ranger here. There are too many corporate lobbyists. They started beefing up their lobbying in Washington, including the auto industry. And
let me just stop you because, Ralph, let's not bypass the fact that GM mounted a pretty intense and dirty campaign against you.
Yes, they hired a private detective with several former FBI people. That's what happened to a lot of FBI agents when they retired to go to work for these large corporations, to follow me around the country, try to get dirt on me, to discredit my testimony before Congress. And the Detroit paper, Bob Irvin, first wrote the article fingering GM is behind this. And then all the other press jumped on. And that's when Senator Ribicoff had his widely publicized hearings. And then it shifted over to Senator Magnuson, who reported the bill out to the Senate floor. So that helped, of course. But then I started going after other industries, the pipeline safety issue, the insurance industry, and others. And it, for a while, it worked like a charm. We recruited law school students who just graduated or over the summer, and the Washington Post publicized one of their reports exposing the weak Federal Trade Commission. And the Congress had hearings. There was hearings at the House, and we had five young law students testify, and the Post called them Nader's Raiders. So that was a very useful moniker for more media. And we did one report after another on the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Food and Drug Administration, the Interstate Commerce Commission, the FAA, and each one got coverage. Now, when you get coverage in the Times or Post or AP, or you get coverage on TV and radio because the original content comes from the newspapers, and then, you know, NBC, ABC. So I got on Meet the Press, for example. I got on a lot of radio. I got on the evening news. And then we started getting Nader's Raiders, major media, to broaden the base. And it worked like a charm. The members of Congress couldn't shrug us off because they didn't want to be criticized by columnists like Drew Pearson in the Washington Post or the regular news reporters on Capitol Hill. There would be hearings, there'd be legislation. And we got not just the auto safety law, we got the consumer product safety law, we got the flammable fabrics protection law, we got in the environment area, the Fundamental Air and Water Pollution Control Acts, started the Environmental Protection Agency, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, and the Freedom of Information Act, on and on. And then something happened.
And let me stop you there, Ralph. Ralph, let me just stop you there to make two points. One, what you did was create organizations, Common Cause, all these organizations, which you then spun off. They became kind of autonomous consumer agencies, environmental agencies. So you created a counterweight to corporate power, number one. And number two, I think we have to delineate the relationship you had with the press then and now, because these reporters, there was an alliance between your work and those reporters. Is that correct?
Yeah, but we weren't asking for favors, Chris. We said to him, hold us to the standard of newsworthiness. That's all we ask of you. And so they did, and we were very newsworthy. So much so that Ben Bradley, the celebrated editor of the Washington Post, charged out of his office into the newsroom one day, holding up the Washington Post that covered one of our reports, and he said, why aren't you guys digging in like Nader is? What's going on here? So that launched even more investigative reports that had nothing to do with us. And then the television began picking up and say, you know, this is good for ratings. Let's have an on-site consumer reporter for the evening news. And that spread around the country. Yeah, I started the Center for Auto Safety, Public Citizen, the Pension Rights Center, the public interest research groups around the country, and many other groups. Because, again, I didn't want to be a lone ranger. We had to have much more resources, many more people, to counter the hordes of corporate lobbyists and their PACs. So this went on until probably 1974, 75.
Let me just stop you, because 1971 is a pivotal year. That's when you get the kind of corporate blueprint for the blowback, for, you know, the Powell memo.
Right.
And you're the only person named to be targeted in that memo. So corporations feel heat from grassroots, civic, popular movements, unions, and they react. But let's just briefly raise the 71 Powell memo, because they kind of followed it to the letter, what corporations proposed doing, and then the effects of that.
Well, Lewis Powell was a corporate attorney in Richmond. He represented utilities and other companies, and he was asked by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce for advice on what to do with the rousing activity on campuses, the students, the anti-war, the civil rights, women's rights movement, criticism of big banks and other corporations, the eruption of resistance to pollution, and at that time, the early Earth Day mobilization. And he wrote a memorandum.
I'm sorry, Ralph, I don't want to, you started Earth Day. That was your idea, right?
Yeah.
I believe. Is that correct?
And he wrote a memorandum, about 33 pages, just read it recently, and he basically said, hey, we got to wake up. We're the business community. These people, they're not just radicals. They're regular people that are very turned off, and they want to regulate us. They want to tax us. They want to sue us. And we've got to beef up our lobbying. We've got to have a good presence on campus. We've got to do much more media. They listened. And they did beef up. But the pivotal change was not that. The pivotal change was Abe Rosenthal, the new managing editor of the New York Times. And he was what we would call now a neoconservative. He was a foreign reporter for the New York Times in Poland and elsewhere. And then they made him managing editor, and he did not like us. He was opening suburban editions to the New York Times. He wanted more ads. He thought we were bad for business. And he basically started to shut us down. The first thing he did is he told the Washington Bureau that if we come out with a critical report of a corporation and the corporation does not respond, they are not to report on our findings, on our revelations. Well, you know, that doesn't take long for corporations to find that out. And so they didn't respond. So the Washington Bureau would send the article up to New York for publication, and it wouldn't get in. He then didn't like Arab Americans, particularly. He was a staunch supporter of the Israeli government, can do no wrong in those days. And there was not a little bigotry here involved, as people told me at the time. And so he wanted basically to shut us down. and the coverage began to decline in the Times. Well, if the coverage declines,
Ralph, let me stop you there. First of all, most people don't know or may not know you're of Lebanese descent. But secondly, we also that was a moment when the New York Times had severe financial distress. It was not bringing in the ad revenue, and what Abe Rosenthal did was create all the sections that we now see today: style, you know, business, all this stuff, which were just magnets for advertisers, high-end advertisers. And so Abe used to, walk around and say, you know, I save the New York Times. Well, many of us would argue he destroyed the journalistic integrity of the New York Times, but he did so by catering to these advertisers. And part of that catering was, one, to create these special sections that have nothing to do with journalism at all. Many of it was, in fact, paid content. And secondly, it was to erase the kinds of reports that you were doing, and both the kinds of investigative reports that these big advertisers didn't want.
Yes, and at the same time, the companies hired a firm called Wilmer, Cutler, and Pickering, and Lloyd Cutler would go and have meetings with editors of the New York Times and Post and saying, what are you guys doing giving this guy so much print? Don't you know he's bad for business? And the inference was that they were going to lose advertising if they didn't shut us out. And so once the Times started scaling down, then the Washington Post took note, because they were of the same mindset, and both of them were about to go public and sell stock on the stock exchange, which gave them even more vulnerability to suppression. And then that dried up more and more of the evening news. We used to get on the network news. It's almost impossible to get on the network evening news now. And the same with radio. At the same time, there emerged public radio and public broadcasting, and they were scared from the get-go that the companies would go after their funding on Capitol Hill and crimp their style. And so they covered us very little as well. And who took notice? Obviously, members of Congress. And if you, it broke the cycle of Civics 101. You put the truth and the facts out, the public gets informed because the press covers it. The legislators or regulators see the press covering it. They begin to rise to their responsibilities. They have hearings. They take action. People's lives are saved. Health is advanced. Their economic well-being is protected. And then the cycle starts again against the whole set of new injustices. But all these forces I've just mentioned started shutting us down. We were saved for a short period by the Jimmy Carter administration. He appointed very good people to the regulatory agencies, the Auto Safety Agency, the Job Safety Agency, the EPA, and so on. But that was just a four-year reprieve, and they were still counterattacking. More lobbyists, more political action committees, more indignant calls to reporters and editors and publishers to shut us down. And that was their golden age. The mass media, what we call now the corporate media. And it's completely changed now. And I say to reporters or editors or publishers that I can manage to reach, it's not easy, what are you ashamed of your golden age for? Look what you did for the country, just exercising your duty and professional responsibilities for newsworthiness, and now you don't do it.
Ralph, there was another factor, too, and that is the infusion of corporate money into the Democratic Party, because you could not have held these hearings or passed this legislation, which many of which you wrote, unless you had a viable liberal wing of the Democratic Party willing to take on corporate power. And that was eviscerated, in particular, during the Clinton administration, led by a California congressman named Tony Coelho.
Yeah, Tony Coelho was in charge of fundraising for the House Democrats. And around 1978-79, when Carter was president, he managed to get the party to accept the following proposition. Why are we letting the Republicans raise all that money from the business community? We can raise money from the business community. And they started going to these dinners in Washington, PAC dinners, they were called, and making the pitch for money. And that was the beginning of the end, because it coalesced with the defeat of Jimmy Carter by Ronald Reagan. And once Reagan took over, well, you know, he gave wish lists to companies. So you go to the oil and gas company, the banks, and the insurance companies, and so on, and say, well, what do you want us to do for you in terms of getting rid of regulations, tax cuts, nominating conservative judges to the federal bench, and so on? It was all downhill. You could see the correlation between the campaign money pouring into the Democratic Party coffers and the decline in regulatory action and congressional hearings when they controlled the House or the Senate.
And I know when you first ran for president, I think it was I remember you telling me that it was done essentially because Congress had become completely captive, that all of those Congress people, Fulbright and others that you were once able to work with, had been essentially pushed out of the Democratic Party, that it had been seized. The entire party and the Congress had been seized by corporate power. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Especially in 1980, the landslide against Jimmy Carter by Ronald Reagan, a grade B actor who had spent some years as governor of California. We lost Senator Magnuson. We lost Senator Church. We lost Senator Nelson. These were the champions, and others were about to be defeated. We had strong progressive Democratic senators from North and South Dakota. Jim Abares, for example. We had Senator George McGovern. We had two progressive senators, and now they're all Republicans. There is hardly a shred of the Democratic Party in four mountain states and the two prairie states. So they now, having abandoned them, they start with a handicap of 12 senators that don't even compete to challenge in the U.S. Senate. It's pretty hard to control the Senate when you start with 12 down from the get-go. So, what you said is was the trend, and it got worse and worse. Instead of getting a stronger Democratic Party, a stronger progressive movement, it got weaker. The sign of a decaying democracy is that when the forces of plutocracy, oligarchy, multinational corporations increase their power in all sectors of our society, the resistance gets weaker. Now, in a healthy democracy, the resistance would get stronger. There'd be more marches, demonstrations, litigation, candidates running for office, and, of course, more lobbying groups by new citizen organizations. And we saw just the opposite. And the price we're paying right now, the end product of all this, is Donald J. Trump, der Führer. The voters in this country, seeing just two alternatives, the Republican Party and Democratic Party, on November 5th, narrowly elected a lawless dictator who is now at large in our White House, dismantling what's left of the Democratic accountability, the role of Congress, and dictating anything he wants to do. In fact, in July 2019, he said, with Article 2, I can do whatever I want as president. And he's proving it, both in his first term and even on a more greater rampage in the last few days, starting his second term.
But all of this was the rot preceded, of course, Trump, even from the first administration, the destruction of civil liberties, including our right to privacy with wholesale surveillance, the destruction of due process, And you have been very critical of the liberal class, the Democratic Party, for either being active or complicit. I remember you once saying, where are the heads of all the law schools? Well, why aren't they speaking out? Even before Trump ran, when you were running, I remember you telling me once, you know, it's just